Good evening. Congress hears from protesters who say police violated their rights. Could Trump be reelected? Voter security under siege from the GOP. A flag burner speaks out, and Palestinians resist an illegal takeover of the West Bank. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, July 3rd, 2020. Donald Trump will rail against what he says is a left-wing mob seeking to tear down U.S. history. He plans to make the incendiary statements at Mount Rushmore on Friday, the site of a monument built on Native American lands and seized by the U.S. in violation of numerous treaties, broken over centuries of European occupation of Indian territory. Trump's speech in the Black Hills comes amid concerns over holding a large gathering during a pandemic and criticism from Native Americans. The event, scheduled for 10 p.m. tonight, will follow a fireworks display at the South Dakota landmark depicting images of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. Two of the presidents were slave owners. Some 7,500 people are expected to attend the outdoor event. The governor has said masks and social distancing will not be required. Meanwhile, earlier this week, the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties held a virtual briefing on violence against protesters and journalists after the police killing of George Floyd. Democrat Jamie Raskin of Maryland chaired the hearing.
Trump and Attorney General Barr managed to violate and offend every single right contained in the First Amendment when they assembled a secret and unidentified paramilitary squad of federal officers and unleashed pepper spray, tear gas, and rubber bullets on a crowd of peaceful protesters, many of them my constituents and attending reporters, all in order to clear a path for the president to get uninvited to the St. John's Church, Episcopal Church, so he could perform certainly the most grotesque photo opportunity in the history of the United States, waving someone else's Bible upside down over his head. This violent and cartoonish display of banana Republican values trampled the right to, one, peaceably assemble on the streets and sidewalks without being assaulted by government forces. Two, the right to petition your own government for a redress of grievances without being physically attacked by unidentified federal agents. Three, the right to freedom of speech. Four, the right to free press. Five, the right to free exercise of religion without government officials coming to occupy your church property for political reasons and then barring you from access to your own church the next day. And finally, the right not to have government establish religion by fusing governmental and ecclesiastical power, which is surely what President Trump intended to do in his own inartful and incompetent way by brandishing the Bible like a political prop, provoking outraged responses from both the Episcopal and Catholic bishops of Washington, D.C. for this act of narcissistic idolatry.
My name is Gustavo Martinez, and I'm a staff reporter for the Asbury Park Press. I have been a journalist for 16 years and have covered political protests and similar events across three countries for more than a decade. I speak up today because the silencing of journalists by law enforcement is a fundamental threat to American democracy. I saw people being pepper sprayed by the police. I headed towards them to document what was happening. And from the corner of my eye, I saw a large police officer launching toward me. No sooner had I hit the ground than another officer yelled, quote, "Take down his effing phone," end quote. The phone was slapped out of my hand.
My name is Latoya Ratliff. In 1964, my great aunt, Fannie Lou Hamer, told the story of how she and 17 other freedom riders risked their lives to register to vote, and how police were used to intimidate, assault, and violate the civil rights of she and other citizens who had broken no laws. They called her nigger, arrested her, and took her to a cell where she was beaten mercilessly. Like hundreds of millions of people around the world, I was shocked and disgusted by the murder of George Floyd. I wanted to do something. As I walked through Fort Lauderdale that day, I looked around. The police began firing tear gas and shooting rubber bullets. Officer Eliezer Ramos shot me, a peaceful demonstrator, an unarmed woman in the head with a rubber bullet. While merely exercising my First Amendment right to speak out against police brutality, I became the type of victim that I was there to support.
My name is Jenny Gerbasi, and I serve as the rector at St. John's Episcopal Church in Georgetown. I previously served on the clergy staff of St. John's Lafayette Square. Suddenly, I saw and heard protesters running from Lafayette Park. I saw trails of smoke and billowing clouds of acrid smoke billowing through the crowds. The first flash grenade rang out, sounding like gunfire, and I saw people dropping to the ground in fear that it was gunfire. I remember looking at my watch. It was 6:36, well before the 7 o'clock curfew. I heard someone yell rubber bullets, and I looked up from washing the man's eyes to see a man in front of me holding his stomach and bent over. And then I looked over his shoulder. A wall of police in full riot gear was physically pushing people off the St. John's patio, maybe 15 feet away from me. When I later found out that the president had, just minutes later, stood in front of the church and held up a Bible, I was outraged. My clergy colleagues and I were there in the name of those same scriptures.
The House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. We heard from LaToya Ratliff, great niece of civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer, who was shot in the face with a rubber bullet, among other witnesses. And the United States Supreme Court issued a 5-4 ruling Thursday night, blocking a lower court's decision to allow curbside voting and expanded absentee ballot access in Alabama's July 14th runoff election. The president has baselessly claimed that mail-in voting will lead to massive electoral fraud and a rigged 2020 election, despite the fact that evidence shows voter fraud regarding mail-in ballots is exceedingly rare. And the Trump campaign and Republican National Committee have launched a massive legal campaign designed to block Democratic attempts to broaden voter access. Some Democrats, repeating similar claims in 2016, are saying Trump's recent slide in the polls means he hasn't a chance to be reelected in November. Democratic commentator James Carville went so far as to make the same claim on television. But reporter Greg Palast, author of How Trump Stole 2020, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters, says it's foolish to think the election couldn't be stolen at the ballot box.
Polls mean nothing. The vote count means everything. According to MIT, you lose 22% of all mail-in ballots are never counted. One in five, okay? Now, whose votes don't get counted? The studies say Hispanics, African Americans, young people, low-income people. These are the people who get shafted out of their mail-in ballot more than anyone. And we have no choice but to go to mail-in ballots or we die. So what's going to happen is we're going to lose. We're going to have a massive fall in the number of votes that will be counted. Understand that if you don't get your ballot in the mail, you can't mail it back. And about 10%, 12% of all ballots, mail-in ballots, are never received by the person who expects to get their ballot. So they don't get it, they can't vote it. I spoke to the head of the Georgia ACLU, Andrea Young. Her dad was mayor of Atlanta. Her husband received his ballot on June 10. The election was June 9. This is the head of the ACLU who asked for her ballot 45 days in advance. What about you listening? You think your vote's going to count? You think you're going to get your ballot? Good luck. Millions and millions of ballots in America don't get counted. And this is what was not calculated in 2016. Carville had the same moronic line. Look at the polls. No way for Trump to win. And then he did, because he wasn't figuring the steal.
I think of Tammany Hall in New York. I think of the 19th century. I think of Lyndon Johnson allegedly stealing an election for Kennedy in 1960 and annoying to no end Richard Nixon. Does this thing happen in this day and age?
Especially in this day and age. In my book, I actually calculate very carefully from government records. We have an agency called the Elections Assistance Commission, which tracks voting and non-voting, whose votes get canned. And according to those records, Trump lost. Even in the electoral, if you counted the votes that were deep six. So, for example, you mail in your ballot and you put an X next to a candidate's name instead of fill in the bubble, you just lost your vote.
Who's behind this kind of thing?
Mostly the GOP. Some Democrats have dirty hands, too, on this. They discount ballots. They don't count your vote, so they'll say, oh, you mismarked your ballot. And it's not a small number. Do you know that we had 1.9 million ballots disqualified because of mismarks? according to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, the chance of your ballot being disqualified for a technical reason is 900% higher if you're black than if you're white. Nine times more likely you'll lose your vote if you're black than you're white. And so you take 1.9 million votes, you say the majority of them are voters from cast by voters of color, and in that pile is Hillary Clinton's victory. Michigan, 16. Trump won that by 10,700 votes, except 75,355 ballots, to be exact, were never counted in Detroit because 87 scanners broke down. 75,000 Detroit residents, and I met some of them. I did this investigation for Democracy Now!, by the way. Hillary Clinton's election is in that pile of thrown out votes. We have a Jim Crow election system. Do you think that they just beat and shoot black men and then let them vote? On what planet? That ain't the United States.
What do we do about this? Well, how can we stop this from happening? Do you have any prescription?
Okay. In How Trump Stole 2020 is the formula for how you steal back your vote. We've had 17 million people purged from the voter rolls in the last 2 years. You know how you defeat it? You re-register. Every single person listening to me, please use your brain. Go on the state Secretary of State's website. Type in your name and birth date to make sure that you are registered. Literally millions of people have lost their registration, don't know it. I was in Atlanta with Martin Luther King's cousin, 92 years old, voting at the same voting station for 50 years, and they said, you're no longer registered, or we have no record of you ever voting here, no registration, you're purged, get out, scram. Her niece was like in burst into tears. It was horrible. If she had checked her registration, it wouldn't have happened. Check online, and if you're not registered, register on the spot. And if you've moved at all, re-register. There's things you can do. And then also, when you're talking about mail-in ballots, make sure you understand the rules and have people check it out. In several states, like Wisconsin, you have to mail in your ID. In several states, you have to have a notary, like in Alabama. You're going to have to work at voting because you have a bunch of people working at stealing your vote. You're going to have to work at stealing it back. We can overcome the voting shenanigans. It's not even whether you're for or against Trump. It's a question of if you're for or against democracy. But if you are going to go to sleep like people did in 2016.
The name of the book, where it is available, and how folks can learn more about this.
The book will be out and available on July 14th, Bastille Day. That's in a couple weeks. And it will be launched by Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky for Pacifica Stations. So stay tuned, How Trump Stole 2020. And again, that book will tell you how to steal it back.
Reporter Greg Palast, author of How Trump Stole 2020, The Hunt for America's Vanished Voters. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. At his rally in Tulsa last month, Trump said he wants to make flag burning a crime, punishable by 1 year in prison. It's part of his campaign to defend Confederate and other statues to slave owners and other less than exemplar representatives of American history. The problem, in 1989, the United States Supreme Court in Texas versus Johnson ruled 5-4 flag desecration was protected speech. The event, or that led to that trial, that led to that case, originated with a 1984 protest at the Republican National Convention in Dallas, Texas, where a protester named Gregory Joey Johnson burned the flag to protest the renomination of then-President Ronald Reagan. Johnson, a supporter of the Revolutionary Communist Party, fought a 2-year jail sentence for the offense all the way to the Supreme Court. Johnson tells WBAI he plans to burn the flag again tomorrow in Los Angeles to protest Trump's attempts to make flag burning a crime once again. Johnson says Trump is a fascist who's out to make criminals of his opponents.
We live in a society where there's an end to institutionalized racism and murder by the police and nothing less. An end to any way people anywhere are used, abused, and brutalized, and nothing less. The whole system that we live under is saturated with white supremacy and oppression of whole peoples. It's an empire built on wars and of conquest and occupations and invasions and torture and coup d'etats and carpet bombings and Agent Orange and white phosphorus and drone bombings of villages and massacres. The only way it's going to end is through an actual revolution to overthrow the system of capitalism and imperialism.
How can we be sure that this is just human nature, and that who's ever in control will just find some other group of people to napalm and bomb, and that if we didn't do it to them, as I've heard it said to me, they would do it to us.
Some humans have already demonstrated they're capable of quite self-sacrificing, quite enormously generous and considerate actions and activity, and dedicated their lives to nothing less. At the same time, we live in a system where the social relations are shaped fundamentally by the mode of production, and we live in a capitalist, imperialist system that forces people to compete one against the other. If you're an imperialist and you're not ruthless, then you run the risk of being outstripped or surpassed or overthrown or made irrelevant. Millions of people in the inner cities in this country are destined with having no real viable future under this system because they've become extraneous to the capitalist accumulation process. The leader of the revolution, Bob Avakian, has written a constitution for, and in anticipation of bringing that kind of a society into being, a constitution for the new socialist republic, the people's security forces that you talk about would sooner take a bullet than to wantonly murder one of the masses of people in the new society.
The real problem with America isn't too much nationalism, but under Trump, the leaving out of people from nationalism.
Conservative or liberal, this is a system that was born in the throes of genocide against the indigenous people, slavery as part of the whole accumulation process of capitalism. This is an imperative for this system. You don't have to live in a society like that.
What are you going to do tomorrow?
Tomorrow, on the 4th of July, I'm going to be out in Hollywood at Coinga Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard at 1 p.m., where the Revolution Club has called a Demonstrate How to Dishonor the American Flag rally and march. And I'll be burning the flag in defiance of the fascist Trump's call to recriminalize flag burning, Trump's attempting to overturn the decision in my Supreme Court case, Texas versus Johnson in 1989, that decided flag burning is protected, is constitutionally protected speech.
What do you say to those people who say what you're doing when you burn the flag is actually upholding what is great about America?
The reason that I was able to achieve this victory in the Supreme Court was not because the Constitution has this inviolable framework that is permissive of this. The Supreme Court has taken the exact same questions of law at different points in the history of this country and ruled one way at one moment in history and ruled another way at another moment in history. And I attribute my victory in 1989 more to the struggle of the people in the 1960s who did a whole range of forms of expression with the flag, and people fought legal cases around all of that. And so there was a whole history of decisions of people fighting for this. The question has never been definitively answered in the 1960s. And now, as Trump says, he thinks because there's a new Supreme Court, they'll be friendly to overturning the decision in my case. Tell me what exactly I'm supposed to be grateful for. I have a moral obligation to do this, and I'm part of the movement for an actual revolution to get humanity beyond this whole system.
Gregory Joey Johnson, who burned the flag to protest the renomination of then-President Ronald Reagan in 1984. He says the group Refuse Fascism will meet tomorrow at Columbus Circle at 1 p.m. to march to Trump Tower. Then at 4 p.m., also at Columbus Circle, they plan to show how they feel is the best way to dishonor the American flag. And July 1st was supposed to be the day Israel annexed huge swaths of the West Bank after annexation was approved by the Trump administration. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had aimed to start the process by Wednesday, last Wednesday, saying he wanted to begin annexing West Bank territory in line with President Trump's Mideast plan. The move would violate international laws and treaties since the 1940s that give Palestinians rights to land claimed by Israeli settlers. A Palestinian journalist, Ramzi Baroud, says the move is more of the same treatment Palestinians have been getting for years, but that now it's not Israel, but the United States that's forcing the issue.
What the Trump administration has done since its advent to office is to basically okay all the Israeli moves aimed at normalizing the occupation, and now they want to officiate that by making the occupation legal under Israeli law. Of course, it remains to be a violation of international law, but the Israelis now feel that they have the needed political backing from Washington to go ahead and make it so-called legal, and therefore Palestinians supposedly have nothing to fight for anymore.
What would that entail? Would like the Israeli army move into areas that are Palestinian? How would we see this play out? And is it going to happen soon, like any day?
This was actually supposed to happen on July 1st. The reason that there was a bit of a delay is the response of the international community was maybe something that Israel did not expect. And they are, you know, they are fearing that by doing so, I mean, even the Vatican is extremely angry by this. Yesterday, they summoned the American and Israeli ambassador saying you cannot change the status quo. This is still a military occupation and so forth. So I think, and many analysts agree, that what Netanyahu might end up doing is annexing the areas in which the illegal settlements are situated, and slowly, through kind of a long-term process, make the annexation of about a third of the West Bank, 30% of the West Bank, to be legal, but in a more progressive way, so that they don't risk an international response that could bring a lot of bad attention to Israel in coming months.
Isn't that pretty much what was happening already?
That's exactly what's been happening already. In fact, we are talking about the annexation of the Jordan Valley. Well, guess what? 85% of the Jordan Valley have already been, you know, used by the Israeli military. Palestinians are not even allowed to venture into it, and they have been slowly ethnically cleansed from that area. The only difference between what has been happening in the past and what's happening now is that if Israel itself says this is now part of the so-called Israel proper, it means that tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of more Jewish settlers are going to end up moving there with the complete support of the government. They don't even need any special governmental laws to make settlements legal or illegal, because this is how it usually works in Israel. You want to build a settlement, you have to go through a political decision, not through the municipality, not through the city. Now this becomes a local affair to be determined by city councils and by settlements to build and expand as they please without having to go through the Israeli government anymore.
Where are these Israeli settlers going to be coming from? I mean, they're going to move from within Israel to the West Bank, or are they going to be coming from outside the country?
Usually the flow of settlers happens in multiple directions. Sometimes there are settlers who already live in the West Bank, move from one area to the other, oftentimes coming from Israel itself, and quite often coming from outside the country, including a large patch of them often comes from the United States.
So this is United States colonialism in a way.
Very much so. And now it has the complete backing of the U.S. government. David Friedman, the American ambassador to Israel, according to Haaretz, an Israeli newspaper a few days ago, said that actually it was Friedman who insisted that Netanyahu needs to take advantage of the American support and declare the annexation as soon as possible, which is really quite interesting because it's usually the other way around. The Israelis pressure the Americans relent and get away with whatever they want, but now it's the other way around. Jared Kushner, David Friedman, the Jason Greenblatt type of gang, if you will, are the ones who are now orchestrating the Israeli colonization of the Palestinian West Bank.
Part of America's long-term desire to control oil in the Middle East.
Very much so. I mean, we talk about annexation, but what the annexation is only a branch of a larger so-called American vision. You know, that they want to normalize between corrupt Arab regimes and the Israeli government. They want to completely disregard Palestinians and marginalize them entirely as part of the so-called the U.S. Middle East plan. It's not a peace plan at all. It's a new vision that Israeli aims at solidifying American presence in the Middle East, of course, at the expense of democracy, at the expense of the people of that region, in order for them to guarantee their strategic control of the wealth of that region. And of course, they continue to use Israel the same way that Israel continue to use them in whichever political and economic agenda they have in mind.
Fundamentalist Christian Americans, too, have a dream of this part of the world coming under American control.
This has been building up for many years, well prior to to the Trump administration being in power.
What is going to be the Palestinian response to this?
The Palestinian Authority response, I mean, let's be honest, the Palestinian Authority is an outcome of an American-Israeli agreement. They were invented by the so-called peace process, which is an American political stratagem. Now they are finding themselves completely orphaned. They are abandoned. They are financially bankrupt, which means that it's either A, the Palestinian Authority would have to dismantle itself and merge within a larger political body, and that is the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, or kind of take it to its chances and face the ire of the people who are, frankly, completely fed up, not only by the Israeli occupation and the violence of the settlers, but by the corruption and nepotism of the Palestinian Authority that is becoming richer at the expense of the people, who are now facing not just the obstacle of Israel, but the obstacle of their own corrupt political elites.
Palestinian journalist Ramzi Barood, the annexation is opposed by numerous countries, including France, Germany, Britain, and the European Union. And finally, the Washington Redskins began a thorough review of their name Friday, a significant step towards moving on from what experts and advocates call a dictionary-defined racial slur. Even though owner Dan Snyder had shown no willingness to change the name since buying the team in 1999, the recent national conversation on race has renewed opposition to the name and prompted sponsors to speak up. With support from the NFL, it may finally lead to a new moniker for the long-struggling storied franchise with long-ago Super Bowl success. In a statement, the team said recent events around the U.S. and feedback from the community prompted the formal review. Native American advocacy groups have tried for decades to force a change, and a peer-reviewed UC Berkeley study released earlier this year revealed 67% of those surveyed who strongly identified as Native agreed or strongly agreed the name was offensive. The death of George Floyd in Minnesota and other examples of police brutality against black people in the U.S. sparked protests worldwide and changes to various brands considered racially insensitive. And that's some of the news for Friday, July 3rd, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Have a great Independence Day.